sinners have their sorrow, the wretched have their rage. Pray for the aged, it's the dawn of another age, of another age, of another age, of another age, of another age.
Welcome to Radio Free Canada. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, with Ryan Gable. Welcome to our final show of the year. We are resuming broadcast on February 7th at the same time and hour, according to our plan, and thanks to the good folks at BBS Radio. And with me, of course, is Ryan Gable today. It's November 29th, and today we're going to be joined by two guests who will help us recap our long struggle to stop genocide in Canada and establish a new nation stripped of corrupt and murderous colonial legacies. With us today are fellow activists in the campaign Laurie O'Rourke from the West Coast and Peter Yellowquill of the Anishinaabe or Ojibwe Nation in Manitoba. Laurie has campaigned with us for over a decade to expose crimes in the prison and death camps called Indian residential schools, and she helped lead church occupations in Vancouver to confront these criminals. She also co-produced our historic documentary film Unrepentant that first shed light on these murders. Peter Yellowquill is a survivor of the residential school death camps, and he now leads his people in defense of their land, their children, and their hereditary sovereignty in the face of Canada's ongoing genocide. Well, all that said, I think the way we can almost sum up the year and really sum up the reason we're here is a simple question. How does a moral man or woman respond to the fact that their government and churches and all the institutions of law have killed tens of thousands of children, trafficked and raped them and tortured them and killed them? They've hid their crime and are now continuing that crime. How does a moral man or woman respond to that fact? Well, the law, including natural law and international law, has a simple answer. You respond by not participating. You disassociate yourself from that crime and you try to nullify those responsible for it. Now, that simple choice and requirement of the law is really the basis for our movement to first document and then expose and prosecute and finally replace a criminal system. And that's what we're all about. And what we want to talk about tonight and leading into 2016 is the fact that we now are operating under a new paradigm. We're not concerned about reforming or goading or changing the old system, which has fallen. We are creating new systems based on our own sovereignty and justice and autonomy. This is where we're at, and we welcome you tonight to the show. Please continue to follow our links at bbsradio.com, Radio Free Canada. The shows are still archived there until we return on February 7th. Ryan, welcome back. Always good to be with you.
You as well, brother. I'm glad to be here today, and I think that we've got a bunch to talk about the last show for the year, and I'm excited to hear what our guests have to say.
Yeah, let me bring on Laurie now, Laurie O'Rourke from the West Coast. Hello, Laurie.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. I just gave you a little promo. I don't know if you heard it.
I did, you're involved.
Helping seize Holy Rosary Cathedral that day. A wonderful day it was. We're going to, one of the things before Peter comes on in about 10 minutes is I want to just run by both of you the fact that recently in the press, and this is something we'll be kind of hashing out over the next hour, as part of course, the whole whitewash campaign, which so many people acknowledge now is going on in Canada, the Government of Canada's official whitewash, the so-called Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was quite a misnomer, they claim that all they could find were the records of 3,201 children. Now, that's a funny figure because let me show you the duplicity involved here. What they didn't mention is they based that only on the years 1896 to 1903, because after 1903, the federal government officially stopped publishing long-term death records. That is, they stopped tracking what happened to the children after they left the school, where so many of them continued to die off. They did that because it was such an enormous mortality rate, over 40% in the very first year the children went to these places. But the TRC claims only 3,000 deaths, and then in brackets, of course, over only 14 years. If you extrapolate that number out, you get a figure closer to what we claim, which is 30,000 plus children who are dead. So let me just throw you out there for that out there for your comment.
Yeah, I mean, the duplicity is well, amazing. I mean, their own records that you've been publishing for like 20 years say 50%, you know, between, you know, the first report in 1901 that was in the national papers was, you know, in the schools all across Western Canada that Dr. Peter Bryce had visited was between 25% and 75% death rate.
Right.
And then, you know, so they just, like, completely ignore that. And then, you know, several decades later, one of their own department was saying, well, half the children don't survive to take advantage of the education they get, quote-unquote education. But, I mean, you know, so it's just such a bald-faced lie.
Yeah.
And again, it's like hidden right in plain view, right? If people, yeah. I keep getting people to try and visit the official website, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission website, so trc.ca. And if you go up along the top and it says About Us, and then it says Our Mandate. And if you go into the mandate, it says Section 2. It's all in black and white that these are not formal hearings. There's no formal legal process, that anything of a criminal nature will not be recorded. Unless it's, what does that say? It says, unless it's already been proven in court. Well, since nobody's even been charged with a single murder, how would any of them make it into the report?
Right. And, you know, the other thing, of course, is that if you even name a name at the TRC hearings, it's stricken from the record automatically.
Yeah, it says that right in there. This is Section 2 of the mandate, Part 2H, shall not name names in the report, event, activities, unless this person has been found guilty in a court of law.
Right. And, of course, they've made a point of making sure that no trial has ever happened charging anyone with a crime or with a murder.
So it's not a legal proceeding. It's not an investigative body. We won't record anything of a criminal nature, and then at the end it's like, well, look at that, only 3,000 deaths over the 100 years. Well, what else are we going to come up with?
Now, Lord, you remember when Bill Curry, the Globe and Mail reporter,
came to
Nanaimo and to Vancouver, and he wanted to meet all of these survivors. So we took him around over several days. We met people who had buried children. We met people who had seen deaths. None of that appeared in the Globe and Mail article, but nevertheless, their headline was, Native Children Died in Droves. Okay, now suddenly that article doesn't exist. It's gone down the memory hole because I think you mentioned the other day some person was saying they were quoting, you know, the TRC report as this definitive statement, when in fact it's just a complete rewriting of the narrative, right?
Well, it's a complete lie, and it's just a bold-faced lie. It's... Yeah, I mean, the article was Native died in drove. They didn't report on it. I remember, like, we went around, you know, on foot, the downtown east side, a lot of these survivors aren't walking around with cell phones and living in apartments. We had to go find them, and then we got them all together for these meetings. So we had a room full of people and all sorts of people talking about deaths and what, you know, witnessing murders and burying children themselves, right? None of this gets reported in his thing, and he just reports on sexual abuse. And when you ask, well, why didn't you report on any of this? And he says, well, we couldn't prove it. And he says, did you prove the sexual assault? Like just the sex goes in, because that's titillating for the readers, I guess, but, you know, it's just not there. He just hears it all, and what great reporting. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Ryan, any comments?
Well, I know, first of all, in the process of this TRC, they blew through tens of millions of dollars, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Official was $68 million, but it went way over budget.
Mm-hmm. And that begs the question, what Lori was saying, what's the point then? I mean, if it's not a criminal proceeding, nobody's going to be tried for anything. You can't have names named. The commission is basically ran by the very institution that committed the crimes in the first place, and they blew through tens of millions of dollars. I mean, that in and of itself is a fact that the whole thing was a whitewash just to basically curb public opinion from the start.
Well, I'll tell you, it got so disgusting. I remember going to several of these different hearings. The one in Winnipeg, they spent something like $500,000 of the TRC money to bring in rock bands and to have big smorgasbords, but they wouldn't, get this, they would not pay the travel expenses for survivors to come and tell their stories. You know, I remember a group of five people from Swan Lake came up to me because Peter Yellowquill and I held a meeting after at the University of Manitoba. These five people came and they said, we had gone to Murray Sinclair, the head of the TRC, this Apple Indian chief who was running it. We went to Murray Sinclair with stories that we had seen children get killed and we had buried them. He laughed at us. That was his response. You know, and I mean, this is what we're dealing with.
Yeah, a lot of the people that went to testify basically had to pay their own way to go to go and to actually be able to have commentation. But then obviously if they name names of people that were involved, they were stricken from the record anyway. And I know, Kevin, you said that a lot of the people that got up to speak were also given a certain specific allotted amount of time, but then church officials basically got as much time as they wanted with basically no restrictions.
Well, we have actually a video posted, and Laurie, I'll let you come on this, but Shauna Green, who was a Native woman who went to the Victoria TRC gathering, testifies in a video we have posted up at itccs.org. She said she saw the survivors were given only 10 minutes and their statement had to be vetted first. They had to be looked at and censored if there was anything in it the TRC leaders didn't like. But the Catholic bishop got up and had a half hour to go on about how they were really trying to do the best thing they could in these schools. And when people started shouting to tell him to sit down and tell the truth, Sinclair stands up and tells everyone to show respect to the bishop, right? Show respect to the murderer and rapist. I mean, this is the disgusting thing that we're dealing with. Go ahead, Laura.
Well, just as you're saying that, I mean, it was, and the link was never made, but there was also a spike in suicides in many of the cities after the event blew through town and then left. There would be a spike of suicides.
Exactly. And you know, that as well as that, when the healing, so-called healing funds came out, we saw the same thing in the downtown east side. People remember social worker after social worker were saying, it's too bad they got this money. They're drinking themselves and overdosing to death, you know, because of this. So I don't think that's accidental.
Yeah, it wasn't enough money to get yourself, you know, set up or anything. It was just, like Bingo said, it's just enough for a good drunk, and that'd be it, you know.
I mean, this is not just physical abuse, it's spiritual abuse. And a lot of the times, victims of child abuse, they not only basically have their entire mind warped and melted, and they really have, you know, their entire being has been ruined by the abuse. They do turn to alcohol, they do turn to drugs, and a lot of the payouts from the church to basically cover up the crime, a lot of them had to have been met with confidentiality agreements so that they couldn't speak about it.
Always. Now, we do have Peter Yellowquill on the line. I'll bring him in right now. Hi, Peter, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Peter, it's really good to have you back, and I'm not sure if folks remember you and your whole history and that, but let me just ask you to, you know, say a little bit about yourself, but also we're talking about, you know, this TRC cover-up and the you know, how the cover-up is just as bad as the original crime in a way. And kind of wanted to know from you, what are the effects in your community in Manitoba, the long-term effects of these so-called residential schools?
Well, I'm Peter Yelko. I'm Ojibwe Lakota from up here in Canada. Manitoba, Treaty One area. I think that I spent 11 years in the residential school, and a lot of my friends did also. Most of my family was in residential school, and we find out that for two or three generations. And we're still feeling the effects. I mean, it's I attended the gala, I guess, in Ottawa. On the residential school, I took part in the march. But what is really kind of significant in my mind is we walked right past the scene of the crime, and that was Parliament Hill. And I kept thinking to myself, wait a minute, here's the scene of the crime. We're being shunted off to some city hall, as if it was the citizens of Ottawa and the mayor and the council of Ottawa that that committed the genocide. And so that was a bit offensive. And then when I went to attend the release, and I had brought a memorial for my friends and that I'd lost over the years, and we're still continuing to lose. Through suicide and just drinking themselves to death and ODing, like, and all these things, and men and women, young men and women, and their sons and their daughters, and now their granddaughters and their grandsons. It's I want to lay some stones and a flower and a poppy for the veterans in our area, just at the front there, because they had this some kind of a thing there where you could, I suppose, leave your letters or whatever. But I went up there to lay my stones and my sweetgrass and sage and the symbol of a cross and those other things that were treasures in our lives, I guess, in that sense, memorials. I kind of got shunted off, and I took a deep offense, and I just walked out. I left because it was clear that this was not for me as a survivor. It was there for a few people, too. Yes, they did a lot of work, but I was also there, and I was deeply offended. Sinclair came to the Ottawa site, whatever it was, the City Hall site, and I delivered to him a resolution that I had drafted for the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, and that had passed, and that was to direct him to answer the question of genocide. Not this cultural genocide, the question of genocide in its entirety. He did not have the judicial courage and obeyed what I call his white masters, mm-hmm. and did not address the question, even though he was directed to do so by the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. He still has time to do it, and he won't. It's clear to me that, yes, I agree, there's a lot of work gone in, but when you really look at what's happened here, it's a lot of venting, which is righteous, which is needed. But where is the justice? Was this a quest for justice, or was just a means for Canada to kind of wash its hands a little more?
Yep.
And avoid the real issues. Where is the justice for all the families of loved ones who died in these places? Where's the justice for the criminal act of giving de facto immunity to rapists and murderers by the Prime Minister, the former Prime Minister, Canada, Stephen Harper? And the Department of Justice officials who created this kind of a last blow of genocide, in my view.
Yeah.
Because it was an opportunity for Canada to come clean. The Canadian people are a good people. We know our neighbors that are good people. They helped build this country. But when we found out what was actually happening, okay, we wanted to believe so much. We were so deeply, deeply hurt. We wanted to believe so much that this was going to be a good thing for Canada and ourselves. But it was tarnished. And when we began to find out, wait a minute, you know, we're still second-class citizens. We're still second, third class. We're not as good as this. Even our abuses are not as worthy somehow financially as what happened to the white boys, let's say. Excuse my language. So that leaves a bitter taste in my mouth. It leaves that there's unfinished business. And we don't know if this new prime minister is going to reopen the matters of genocide and also compensation. The only real measure that we have is the compensation one, and it falls far short. And I don't like talking about money, but nevertheless, it was what was thrown at us.
Right.
But this is still affecting our communities. We still have young people. You still have in me difficult times to talk to my own children sometimes. You still have in me that space in my heart, that distance in my heart, that I find so hard to communicate even with my siblings. And it's like I haven't seen one of my sisters for 15 years. The only time we talk is when something bad happens. So in these other generations, like here we're inundated, okay? We're inundated with crack houses. We're inundated with drugs. We're inundated with these things that can mask the pain.
Yeah.
And we've got a generation that's almost saying now, they're literally giving up faith. They're saying, who cares anymore? Don't talk to me about your traditions. Don't talk to me about honest government. Don't talk to me about self-government. Don't talk to me about Christianity even. They just literally just walk away. And we're in a desperate struggle here, okay? In most of our communities, it's the same with the United States or here in Canada. We're struggling with this fallout this still killing us. We didn't come out of those places alive, okay? We're struggling. We're still struggling. But I guess it's not hopeless either. As long as we can still, in some way, try to reach out, I guess, in some way to our kids. And it's getting harder, it seems, but I know that we cannot depend on government. We cannot depend on the TRC. It ended up being more of a slap in the face because the money had already left the bank. Justice has already been thrown out in the streets. All it was a place for our people to vent. And I'm not sure if Sinclair really understood his role, or at least if he did understand his role and legal obligation. This is a judge, okay, a sitting judge. We believe he had the judicial duty, okay, to once he knew the depth and the extent of what happened here, that he should have gone ahead and addressed the question of genocide without turning to his white masters, as I call them.
Yeah.
Because that, to me, is another just a cap on the genocide.
Peter, I remember one of the times we went out, I guess it might have been to the Brandon or the Portage Prairie School. You were standing there and you're pointing out where you thought the kids were buried. And is there any move among your people to bring those children home to give them a proper burial and recognition?
No. Sadly, no. I can tell you that we are in a corrupt state of being politically and administratively. It's even some of our people want to close their eyes, and this is the tragedy. They want to close their eyes to this thing. I've been knocking on doors, and I've been trying to move this council here at Long Plains to really address the conduct of the Crown and even the conduct of the judge. Either they're afraid, or they're just apathetic, or they've been duped. When I first heard the beginning of the apology, I almost lost my heart, so to speak. I began to weep. I began to be overcome with emotion. Until I call him, he's not my hero exactly, but I call him a very, the man from Quebec there. When he talked about our inhumanity in the eyes of the Prime Minister.
Oh, Gilles Duceppe?
Yes. And that's where I just began to say, wait a minute now, time to shut myself down again.
Right.
Time to seal those emotions again.
Yeah.
And let's have a look here at what really happened. And I've been telling to the greatest of my ability to try to talk to some of the other chiefs yet. And that's what drove me to draft a resolution for the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. And
I wanted to ask you about that, Peter, in more detail, but let me just ask if Ryan or Laurie have any questions or of you first, okay?
Okay.
I actually have a question, Peter, for you. Laurie, if you'd like to answer, and Kevin, you as well. What we can really kind of do, and I know we're talking about some of these topics today, what we can do to reverse the whitewash that was the TRC, what we can do to sort of reformulate this and begin to tell the truth. in another way, if that makes sense.
I think it's Peter here. I think that there may be just enough chiefs that can push this the question of genocide. Number one, it's there. I don't believe that Sinclair has the courage to deal with it. However, ever since the comments of the Supreme Court judge, where she used the term cultural genocide, which has kind of just assuaged everybody's feelings for a few years, or it sounds like a few months. But I think that it's going to have to be up to the chiefs who have the courage. Okay, remembering we're not talking about traditional chiefs for the most part. We're talking about people that are elected officials, okay, who themselves have not maybe dealt with this area whatsoever. We see a real swing away from spiritual matters, even from this type of thing, even treaty matters, where everybody's driving for the big dollar now. Economic development is the big thing. They're being led by the nose by the government again. Mm-hmm. But I think it's going to take some legal maneuver or action to try and reverse the effects of the TRC.
Laurie, let me...
Everyone thinks it's over.
Laurie, will you go ahead if you have any comments?
Well, I'm just... what Peter's saying about... Hi, Peter. It's been a long time. About courage and needing some... There needs to be a spiritual... And not in a religious sense, but like a truly centered person who has the courage, because all the eye is on the money now. The entire TRC was a massively expensive show for the whites to feel good about themselves. And it was just a venting session, and it wasn't even like for the survivors. It was really frustrating and deeply even humiliating. And like you said, you lost your heart at the start of the apology, of course, right? Because it becomes clear what truly is going on here. And, you know, survivors to come to these events and be told they've only got 5 minutes and to be quiet and to go away or not be allowed to get up and not be allowed to name names while their abusers are literally walking around in full church regalia and being the center of attention and running the show. What could that cause but more deep, deep heartache? And it Sinclair, yes, he had the duty to do that, but he's not going to do that. It's the white masters all the way along. Every interview I saw with him, survivors' interactions with him at various events, he was very contemptuous to survivors over and over behind the cameras. On camera, he was like shaking hands and being all... doing and saying the right things, but off camera he was horrible to people.
Yeah.
And so no, he's not in it for the right reasons. He was chosen to be there to give a native face and a native quote unquote stamp of approval for the white audience.
Well, let me add too to that it really doesn't matter who was the figurehead under Canadian law. And we tried this in several lawsuits. The judges said each time it's not within our judicial competence to put the Crown on trial for genocide. In the present structure, it can't happen. And that's why, like speaking as a white person who of a culture who did it, the only way those institutions are going to change is if we change them, we bring in something different that isn't based on Crown law, but common law. And we're walking parallel to you, Peter. We've got to do this in our culture, and you've got to do in yours what needs to be done. But we need a whole new ball game here. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, it's frustrating to even try to apply the Canadian law as we know it. There's all kinds of discussions on how do we go about dealing with this matter. I think it's going to take a concerted effort between ourselves, and there's not very many of us left, and Canadians of conscience, to push and change this bizarre legal concept that somehow someone is untouchable and above the law. I find that so offensive because it's just a shield for rapists and murderers of children.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners, too, that we have up online at itccs.org almost 4 hours of the proof that genocide happened in Canada based on documentation, interviews with people like Peter, the eyewitnesses. And later in the show, we're going to kind of annotate some of these points that were left out by the TRC, proving that genocide was intentional and massive. But the fact is that the evidence is already up online. It's already made public. And that's why people don't have the excuse of ignorance. ITCCS.org, it's all there under case number one, genocide in Canada. Please circulate that to your friends. We got to educate people from the grassroots. Anybody, go ahead.
I think it's the propaganda that was inflicted on. Canadians are good people, generally. I believe this with all my heart. But when they began to see what really happened here, of course, the ones in the pews, the grassroots Christians, the other beliefs, Canadians, even amongst our people, we wanted with a good heart to address this. Each of us, including myself, did not know the extent of what really happened here. And we fell for it, and I fell for it too, I'm sorry to say. The money came first. It's an old Indian Affairs trick. I should have recognized it right away. But my heart was being opened to things that I had just left and hope would never come, and it's still difficult to try and relive any of that or try and remember it. I'm trying to focus on, okay, justice.
Yep.
I'm getting lost my train of thought. I'm just getting too emotional.
No, that's okay. We need to get more emotional over this, frankly.
Yeah,
and one of the things in our struggles, whether it's against our chiefs and counselors, whether it's against the province of Manitoba, I don't know why, but I've been involved in these things all my life, is lack of funds. When we do try, okay, like we're millionaires here, say at Long Plain. I'm going to speak specifically because I don't hire nobody. There are funds here that are available to do these things, but they're being, excuse the language, being pissed away. And it's our children's land funds, okay? There's a heartlessness about some of our leadership where they talk about our children, but they don't act for our children. Or they're just like what the old people called Muniash, which doesn't mean white man. It means you're basically full of feces. That's a really derogatory term. And so we've got our people involved in that kind of conduct, and we're literally awash with ecstasy and crack and all these things. And it's hard to reach the young people because we're going to need them. We're going to need them to keep this alive.
Yeah.
Because if we don't have them and we don't educate them, not give them propaganda, get in the real story,
yeah,
then we're going to lose it.
And I think adding to that real story is the fact that a lot of the language that we use, whether it's politically, religiously, or just an average everyday conversation about these topics, is so sanitized, and we really restrict ourselves to using words such as molested or just sexual abuse or pedophiles, when we really don't tell the stories of how children were abused or how the system actually works and get into the details of it. People say, well, that's offensive or that's gross or that's disgusting. Well, people need to hear what actually happened, because I think the way that most view this, whether it's from a church or state perspective, is they view these entities and these so-called leaders as a father figure. So even if your father beats you for doing something you perceive as wrong, you still love your father because he's your father. He's your parental figure. So you still stand up for the church. You stand up for the state because that's your father figure. And people have to understand that this still happens today. This is not an issue from 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago. It's still going on today, both the ramifications of what happened in the past, along with the crimes that are still being committed literally today.
Well, let me throw out something. In our last 15 minutes, I wanted to throw out some meat for people to chew on, even you vegetarians out there. This is stuff that, you know, I found in the records over 20 years, but these are facts now that are being proved. Not only was the death rate in residential schools enormous over 50 years, for example, in the very first year the residential school opened in the West, 1889, in two of the schools in Alberta, the death rate was already 40%. And yet on the surrounding reservations, the death rate was only 5 to 7%. You go into a residential school and half the kids are dying. First point. Secondly, in the period 1910 to 30, it was like an enormous killing zone period. We found that if you look, and these are statistics right from federal government, Statistics Canada published this in 1985. It said in the 1920s, the net population of Aboriginal people in Canada went down by 20%. You had a depopulation of nearly a quarter of all Indians. Now, the reason that was, and one of the reasons, is here are the things that happened in the 1920s. The death rate is enormous at the time in residential schools because of a practice of exposing children, the healthy, to the sicknesses of tuberculosis and smallpox. They never separated the kids. That was a standing policy. Mix the healthy with the sick. They die off enormously. Despite that, and a report by Dr. Peter Bryce reporting on that, the government suppresses the Bryce report and makes it mandatory for every child in Canada to attend those death traps. And at the same time, they abolish medical inspection in the year 1920. 1926, all Indians are barred from hiring lawyers. 1929, churches are made legal guardians of the children. 1929 to 33, sterilization laws are brought in. And time and again, the standard practice of not treating Indians who have tuberculosis. Now, when you look at all of that, there is no way anyone could pretend that was accidental or some benign policy gone wrong. It was a depopulation killing centers. And these statistics are out there. They're up online, itccs.org. And, you know, we're going to be going into more detail about that. But I want to throw that out for, you know, all of you to comment on and think, how can we get this information out to counter these lies that have been put out there?
Even the sanitized version of what defines genocide, all five separate points are clear in the residential school system. That all five points separately are what happened there.
You so mean in the genocide, 5 points of defining genocide in UN Charter, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it, like you said, it's a sanitized version, but at the same time, it's like all five points separately apply to the residential schools. So there's no question of it being genocide. And the other question of intent, well, they didn't write that they intended to. No, but like all the legislations you just pointed out, in order, the dates, just look at the timeline. The intent is clear.
In terms of speaking the language, I attended Halifax at the AFN assembly there a couple of years ago, and I still have trouble with people who use, you know, what you're calling sanitized language. You have to call murder murder. You have to call child rape child rape. And I addressed the chiefs in assembly, and I told them I can no longer accept that apology, and it's for those reasons that they were raping little babies. They were killing and murdering little children. You know? Right now, at the local high school, they are talking about the residential schools as part of the classroom. But we don't know what their curriculum is. We don't know who's saying what or whatever. Sometimes the problem we're having is in our own communities. maybe just because of shame or some, maybe a bit of politics or nepotism or whatever. We have people going forth who are not survivors talking about the residential school, and it's just for the money they're doing it. And as survivors, like, I get offended. I volunteer to speak. I'm not afraid to speak to anyone and everyone, churches, anyone. And there seems to be a kind of a negative backwash when you actually tell the whole truth.
Yep.
That you know. People want to kind of close their eyes to it, but we can't. You know, we just can't. We just can't. It's like trying to close your eyes to the Holocaust. You just can't. The horror of that is it's almost too much to bear or watch. But it's there, and we have to talk about it. We have to speak about it from time to time.
It's almost like you need to do a curriculum, Peter, like doing your own curriculum that you can bring into the schools based on your own experience and what we know to be true.
I agree. But what you do have sometimes is you've got this, here we go again with a little carrot. You've got a little bit of government funding for this, a little bit of government funding for that. We yet to have... even a group of survivors who can say, okay, we are going to do the curriculum for you. We are going to tell the truth. We're going to tell it like it is, whether you like it or not. Because I think all they're getting, I'm not even sure what they're getting in the classrooms at, say, the Portage Collegiate Institute or even things in Winnipeg, the schools in Winnipeg. But
one thing I can tell you is about 4 years ago, the Toronto School Board, some of the teachers there who knew about the work we're doing, we're trying to get some of the basic documents in Hidden No Longer, our book, into the curriculum, like, for example, the death rate. And the local teachers were all in favor of it. And then they got some kind of shutdown from the provincial government. It didn't go forward. The government turned it off, as they so often do these things. So we got to work out some kind of grassroots strategy where we work with just, you know, start locally and work up.
Yeah. And I think the time has to be now, and it has to be done fairly quickly. I'm 64, 63, going on 64. There's not very many of the survivors left here. I can maybe name a handful of my schoolmates that are here, if that. And they're not the ones being invited to speak. They're not the ones being invited to share. So we need a different avenue to try and put this truth out. We need those statistics. What you've quoted to us, what you're hearing here today about the decades of genocidal intent, even our survivors don't know that.
Yeah.
It's kept from them.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if we looked at what's happening at PCI, they wouldn't... they wouldn't have that type of information.
No.
Yep.
And I think it's... but it's clear, though, that if the teachers... And this gives me a bit of hope. If the teachers wanted the truth...
Yeah.
It's really bizarre that, of course... not so bizarre as it sounds. The governments didn't want the truth out.
Well, Laura, you're a teacher. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I... My daughter is in high school right now, and she, you know, they get a little blurb, like literally a paragraph in their textbook on residential schools now. Great big step forward, but again, it's sort of framed as, you know, it was just a sad history. It's shrouded in all this mystery. It's like, oh, some abuse happened, but there's no clarity. Like Peter said, you have to. Murder is murder, and rape is rape, and to say it's, you know, they couldn't use their language, and it's just shrouded in a sort of, like, oh, well, that's too bad, but we don't really get, there's no possible way for someone coming in from the outside to understand what went on with that kind of information. So, I mean, time is ticking, and whichever survivors, I mean, just people should be
I don't know, recording, getting stuff down, and passing it forward. Because, like you said, a lot of the people, you know, when the kids were going through the system, all you could, you know, you were just on daily survival mode. You couldn't see the big picture. There was no way, right?
Well, Lori, what you're also saying is, I think, more than just trying to cover up information by saying that we have, like, the smallest of victories by having a small blurb in a history book, because I think what that does is it makes a first impression on children that hear it. So the next time they hear information contrary, even if they're facts and statistics based on what Kevin was saying, they deny it because their first impression was what they read in the history books, irregardless of whether there was a quote-unquote conspiracy about how much and what information to put in the book to begin with. By simply putting in a small blurb like that, you can control the narrative from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Just like Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Laura.
Well, I just noticed a while ago, I mean, the way the language is deliberately shaped, you know, you'll see in history books, like, from the earliest things for kids now, and it's like, Canada's First Nations were, you know, they were Canada's first people. And it's like, Canada is a very short little blip in the history of time here. These people were here long before Canada was even a concept. They aren't Canada's first people.
Peter, I remember something really powerful that happened. I mean, I've had a lot of powerful experiences in your presence, actually, but one of the things that I was on the Hobima Reserve, and we showed Unrepentant, our documentary film there, shortly after it came out, I think it was like 2008, and I remember there were a lot of young Cree people there, you know, teenagers and in their 20s, and they were dumbstruck at the end of it. They said, we had no idea this is why there's so many problems in our family. You know, that they were trying to kill us off. And they didn't even realize that. And they were in tears. I remember they coming up to me and hugging me and saying, now I feel I can do something. I know why we're in this state. What do you think of that? I mean, to me, it really blew me away when that happened.
It's my mother. Not once did she ever tell me about what happened to her. I didn't even know the reason for the distance between us until I found out that she had been to Fort Qu'Appelle, I think it was, and then Sandy Bay, and lived pretty well all the abuses, survived the abuses. It's like coming home a stranger. And it's kind of like your lips are sealed.
Yeah.
And you don't want to talk about those things. You don't want to. Because what for?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Everybody's sealed.
When you realize that it was generational. Okay.
Yeah.
The other thing that I speak about, and I'm hard for me to talk about. We brought that cancer home with us. We brought the sexual abuses home with us, generationally. And it's the hardest thing for a community to deal with, the fallout from that, especially the sexual abuses. And it's difficult. I worked in justice for about a year here. And I realized one thing. We will never ever heal as a result of any court process, as a result of any judicial intervention. These terrible things that are happening and still happening, we have to address ourselves. We have to man up, we have to woman up, and we have to face this thing. And it's being tried here and there, but we have to do more of it. I told this council here on two occasions, shut the door to the RCMP. Shut the door to the agencies. Shut the door to the courts. Let's face this thing that's going on in our communities. If you want to really, truly heal, at least ease the pain. At least share that pain. Then, if we can do that here, then I believe that we're on our way to healing. And it's not instant. It may be generational healing. But if we close our eyes, if we just pretend it's not happening here, okay? And we accept everything the government says, because that's what's happening. Everybody's accepting what the government says.
Yep.
Then we're doing those dead children, our schoolmates, an injustice. They'll be forgotten soon. Hello?
Yes. No, we're just, it's hard to know what to say when you reach a certain point, you know, Peter, because it's like, I was just thinking about this today, you know, you send out all the information, you get people trying to be concerned, and it's just not there, you know. We have picketed, we have protested, we've occupied, for 20 years struggling, and it's as if with most white Canadians, like, we never did a thing. No impact. And it did have it on a few people, and it did force the government to some degree to react. But, you know, we're back to where we started from. And I don't mean to sound despondent, but that's the hard truth of what we're doing.
Yes. The government knew exactly what it was doing. It knew what to avoid. Okay? You add up 10 residential school students. If they got the same as, say, Mount Castle or some of these judgments against one offender. You got to remember there's two offenders here. It's not just the churches. The other offender was the state.
Yep.
Okay. I mean, it was all about the money.
Yeah.
There was sugar-coated language, healing funds, all those things. But it was all about the money.
It hasn't penetrated people's hearts.
In the end, it leaves a bitter, bitter taste in your mouth.
You know what I think, Peter? Like, it's, and to everybody, we've got about 5 minutes, by the way, or 4 minutes, so I want to allow everyone to say any final comments and to remind people that we'll be back on February 7th, Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. We're taking a two-month break to reorganize and put together some really good shows. But let me just give everybody a chance to say their final piece. Go ahead, Peter.
Here, we are struggling with everything that I've been talking about. It's hard to try and seek the truth, speak the truth, and do the truth in our current environment, but there's enough of us, I believe, in every First Nation to if we can connect. We've started what's called the Promise Keepers. It's an old traditional call of society, but it's a spiritual and a physical duty to do those things for our people. And we're small right now, but we know there's these Promise Keepers in every First Nation. They're part of our traditions. We've just been trying to connect with them, and we believe that's the vehicle, that if we use this traditional obligation and duty and responsibility, that our people will answer. Enough of the committees, enough of the money-driven healing processes. We need a reality check on what our councils are doing, and we need, as people, as Anishinaabek, we need to take on this responsibility here, and that's what we're trying to do here.
Thank you, Peter. We've got about a minute left. Go ahead, Lori.
I just wanted to say thank you to Peter and your work, your everything you're saying. It's perfect. It really is that. It can't be money. It can't be officially sanctioned. Like, that's not going to work. It has to be people of conscience. Thank you.
Thanks, Laurie and Peter, for being our guests today. We're going to carry it on. We'll be doing a lot of other stuff besides the show, so stay posted at itccs.org. Write to us, itccsoffice@gmail.com. Ryan, go ahead.
And my final comment is basically to echo what Laurie said. Thank you, Peter, for coming on the program today. And as we all have said, we can't sanitize the language when we speak of these subjects. We have to have a reality check about what's happened in the past and what continues to happen today. Anyway, though, thank you guys very much, and we'll be back in just a few months probably.
Yes, and I also, just to announce too, I'll be on your shows, Ryan, of course, and we're going to be doing a whole series of mini videos local documentaries, projects like that over the next number of months that, like I say, go to itccs.org for those postings. And on behalf of all of us, I want to thank you for being loyal listeners. Carry it on. Do not lose contact and act on what you've heard today. Because if you don't and you have knowledge, then you're complicit as well as the criminal, unless we act on what we know. So thank you all. Stay strong and stay clear.